Today we have our morning session is going to be started off by Amit Seva, and he's going to tell us about integrability for scattering amplitudes and the six-point amplitude at all loops.
Thank you very much again for the opportunity to speak here. What I'm going to tell about today is some about integrability techniques for computing planar scattering amplitudes. And as you will see, this is a very powerful technique that allows us to do computations, in that case of amplitudes, at finite value of the coupling. So I'm sorry a bit for the metaphor. This is just showing that it's a very powerful technique. And one of the main issues I want to emphasize today is that these techniques are so developed now that we can really start to extract a physical juice out of it. That is, extract some physical input about, in that case, about amplitudes, that otherwise would be very hard to extract. So physical input that only comes about at finite coupling. So I'll start with a very short crash review of what is integrability for those who may not be familiar with, and then we will try to apply it to the problem of computing scattering amplitudes. So integrability is a spectacular miracle that, as we see, can only happen in two dimensions. And what it allows one is to do exact computation in a non-trivial interacting theory in two dimensions. This is just some famous picture from some 1+1 dimensional condensed matter system where you see the integrability prediction with the experiment. So this is something that can really seen in condensed matter system. So one definition of integrability is that you are able to solve exactly. Maybe to be more precise, is the existence of an infinite number of conserved charges. And this, as I want to emphasize, can only happen in two dimensions. So suppose we are in two dimensions, and we have the standard two conserved charges, which is conservation of momentum and of energy, sum of p and sum of p squared, and suppose we scatter in these two dimensions some 2-2-2 particles. As outcome of this conservation of energy and momentum, the only thing these two particles can do is exchange their momenta, but they cannot change the value of the set of these two momenta. Now imagine that in addition to conservation of energy and momentum, there's some higher conserved charges. For example, some q3, which will be the sum of p cubed. Then we apply the same technique for the scattering of free-to-free particles, and what he will tell us is that the outcome can only be some permutation of the incoming momentum, but they cannot change the values. So if we have some free-to-free such scattering, we can now act on it with these new higher conserved charges. And since it acts on each momentum differently, it will shift the free wave packets here, the free particle, in different ways, such that after we act, they will miss each other, and therefore one of the hallmarks of integrability is that the free-to-free scattering amplitude factorize into 2-2-2 processes. Now, this is, of course, can only happen in two dimensions, because if we will do the same in higher dimensions, the particle would miss each other. And this is nothing but the Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem that tells us that in higher dimensional theories, if we have higher conserved charges, the theory must be free. And therefore, the S matrix is trivial. So this is a great story that can only happen in two dimensions. And let me add one comment, that once we have, so this is the case for, if we have free conserved charges, but if you have infinitely many of them, then the same way the scattering matrix of any number of particles would factorize into 2-2-2 scattering. Now a nice way to organize all these higher conserved charges is through a generating function. Just sum over all of them with some parameter to the power n, which is called, this x is called also the spectral parameter. And the way this generating function or holonomy matrix appears, for example, in string theory, is as the integrated holonomy around the string cylinder. And when you expand it in power of x, you get first the global conserved charges, which would be the energy, the momentum, and all the other, in our case, would be conformal supercharges. But when you expand it to higher power of n, you get higher conserved charges, which are non-local from this string worksheet point of view. And the algebra all these higher conserved charges form is called a Youngian. So So this is for the two-dimensional story. But of course, what we want to compute is scattering amplitude in four dimensions and not in two dimensions. So how we apply these techniques now to four-dimensional gauge theory, and the basic idea was put forward by Tuft many years ago, that in the planar limit, in the limit where the number of colors is very, very large, every Feynman diagram, here are some Feynman diagrams that contribute to the potential between a quark and an antiquark, organize themselves in a power expansion of 1 over n, and the leading one in that expansion, you can think about it as being on a two-dimensional surface. Yeah. So this is, for many years, was just a cartoon, but in the past, I would say 20 years, due to the ADS-CFT duality, we understood how to make this cartoon more precise. That is, for a special theory that's called n equal to 4 super young Mills, that I'm sure all of you heard about, the Tuft two-dimensional string turned out to be integrable. And the way we think about such a gauge theory with Tuft string is integrable, we think about it in some sense as the hydrogen atom of quantum field theories. These are the simplest interacting gauge theories that we should be able to solve exactly, and they learn about more complicated theories like QCD and so on. Now here we see a cartoon of these planar diagrams on the boundary of ADS, where the field theory live, and the two-dimensional dual string live in the bulk of ADS. Now this strategy of computing using integrability of the Tuft planar string was first applied for the problem of the spectrum in n equal to 4 super young Mills. That is for the computation of the dimensions of local operators. In that case, the string has a topology of a cylinder, as I saw before, and I refer you to a review of all these techniques for the problem of the spectrum. But what we want to do today is to apply this to the problem of computing scattering amplitudes. So how we apply this to the problem of computing scattering amplitudes? Scattering amplitudes, in the planar limit, the topology of the string is different. It has a topology of a disk. And therefore, there is no place to wrap around this generating function of of all the conserved charges. Okay? There is no place to wrap around the holonomy. So how do we apply integrability to such a problem where the topology is not a cylinder, but is a disk? One idea is the following. We just draw this holonomy that is contractible to a point. Because it's contractible to a point, it's trivial, meaning that all the conserved charges are just equal to zero. But instead of contracting it to a point, we can blow it up and act on the boundary, and what we get is a symmetry that the amplitude should satisfy. In other words, all these conserved charges, all these charges that were conserved for the spectrum problem now should annihilate the amplitude. This idea was first, I think, put forward in a series of papers that I collected under the name of corrected generators that first showed that indeed the three-level amplitudes are invariant under all these conserved charges that form a Yangian, and then it was started to be extended to loop order. And this line of thought ended, you might think, is the Q-bar equation. We tell us exactly how these Yangian generators act and annihilate the amplitude or the generating function of all amplitudes at finite value of the coupling. And the bottom line of all this approach is that indeed, for scattering amplitudes, there is Yangian symmetry which is exact at any value of the coupling. Another approach using that related to integrability for computing amplitudes it's called the on-shell diagram, or the deformed on-shell diagrams. And these are like the on-shell atoms of scattering amplitudes. And these atoms by themselves also are invariant under the same Yangian symmetries. So here is what they call a square mode move, which is related to Young-Baxter equation, which is one of the hallmarks of integrability. And this type of integrability for amplitudes was later extended to to insertion of some deformation parameter, which is called the spectral parameter, in this series of works. So these are two approaches, and the last approach is the approach that I will talk about, is called the pentagon operator product expansion. In this approach, we do something very different. Instead of doing like here, an holonomy around, an act, and generate a symmetry of the amplitude, we draw here the holonomy between two insertions on the boundary of the disk. And now what this holonomy does is compute the state of the string that go through it. And I'll discuss this in more details. This is the holographic cartoon for this picture. So what I'll do today, I will focus about this last approach, the Pentagon operator product expansion. I do it for two reasons. First, this approach, we see, is very, very advanced. It allows us really to compute, and what I'll focus on is the six-point amplitude at finite coupling, or at all loops. And another reason is this is the approach that I've been working on the most. And after describing it at the end, I will comment about possible connections between this approach and the other approaches I described before. So what we shall do now is start by studying this approach. And the main point I want to emphasize is that it's now so developed that we really can start to extract from it the juice at finite coupling. To really now start to answer questions at finite coupling, general questions that otherwise would be very hard to answer. And a few examples I will discuss for scattering amplitudes. So this, I think, is a general comment for the whole subject of integrability in ADS-DFT. But for scattering amplitudes, a few examples that I will discuss today are the following. One of them is, do amplitudes factorize on a multiparticle pole at finite coupling? The factorization of amplitude at multiparticle pole is one of the hallmarks of perturbative computation. For example, the BCFW recursion relation is based on it. Now, does this factorization keep to hold also at finite coupling? This is one question that we can now answer. Another question is, I would not have the time to describe in details, there is also another expansion called the BFKL expansion that so far was done at leading order in perturbation theory by resumming some log. And what we will see is that this expansion is indeed valid at finite value of the coupling. Amplitudes are believed to be computed by some minimal area surface at strong coupling. Having a finite coupling solution, you can go and test and see if this is indeed the case, and you will see that there is some surprises. The last point will not have much time to discuss, but we see how different helicity amplitudes that are not related by symmetries are still related to each other in a simple way. So let's start by explaining what is the operator product expansion approach to computing scattering amplitudes. So we have a scattering amplitude here, and the first question we ask in the integrability approach always is what would be the two-dimensional description that we should view it with and then apply all the integrability machinery to solve. Now here for the problem of the computing scattering amplitude, this is done in two steps. The first step is realizing that in planar n equal to 4 super Young Mills, the computation of scattering amplitudes is the same as computing another object, completely different object, which is a Wilson loop. This is a polygon Wilson loop whose the edges of the Wilson loop are proportional to the momentum of the external particle. It is closed due to momentum conservation, and the edges are null because the external particle are on shell. This is a highly non-trivial duality in n equal to 4 that I would not have time to discuss, and it's indeed very tied to the integrability of the string worksheet, as was shown, for example, in this paper here. So when we now apply integrability machinery to compute scattering amplitude, we will use the right-hand side of this duality, and we will apply it to the Wilson loop picture. Now, how we think about the expectation value of such a polygon Wilson loop? We pick any two edges of this Wilson loop, for example, 1 and 4, and we think about them as the trajectories of a quark and an antiquark that moves at the speed of light. This quark and antiquark create between them a color flux that is dual to some two-dimensional string in ADS, if you think. The way you think about the rest of the edges of this polygon is that the bottom here creates a set of excitations that then propagate on top of the flux and being annihilated at the top. So in other words, we map the computation in that way of computing a scattering amplitude to the computation of computing sort of a partition function on top of a two-dimensional string, with some probability to create excitation here at the bottom and some probability to absorb them at the top. So this is, for example, the picture where we have one flux. But what we do with the, for example, here we have an octagon that has many, many edges. The way you think about this is just a sequence of many, many such fluxes. And then propagate from one to the next. To make it more precise, what we do is the following. We start here from the cusp at the left corner, and we draw the unique null line that go out of this cusp and intersect this edge in the other side. And we continue to do it in an alternated way. What we achieved in this way is a division of the Wilson loop into a sequence of null squares, into a sequence of fluxes. Now note that any two successive squares in this, the compositions, form together a pentagon. Here we have the bottom pentagon, the next red pentagon, and so on. Now the way we think about the computation, therefore, of this Wilson loop is that we start here at the very bottom flux with a vacuum state. Then the next flux has no reason to be in the vacuum anymore, and we have to sum over all the possible states it can be in, so on, until at the very top, we annihilate back to the vacuum. In equation, this picture reads the following. We have to sum over all the states in the three middle fluxes here. Any such state, we have to propagate from the bottom to the top. And the way to propagate the flux to state, they have some energy that I call E, some momentum that I call P, and some angular momentum that I call M. And this energy, momentum, and angular momentum are conjugate to the geometry of this pentagon. In other words, each flux has three symmetries. One is propagating in time, another is propagating in space, and the third one, which is the angular momentum, which is rotation in the transverse space. This is the only place where the geometry of this polygon enter, where the information about the external momentum enter into this expansion. And I have some cartoon, let's see if it works. I guess not. Okay, let's look like that. Yeah. So here is an hexagon, and what this tau really is the approach to the collinear limit. We take tau very, very large. What we do is we flatten the bottom part of the of this hexagon here. And what sigma does is move us along the direction of the flux. Let's move back. Now, the last non-trivial part of these decompositions are the transitions from one flux to the next. And since two squares form together a pentagon, we call them pentagon transitions. We have here first transition from the vacuum to psi 1, then a transition from psi 1 to psi 2, and so on. A way to think about this decomposition is as the analogous of the way we compute correlation function using the operator product expansion in conformal field theories. Also there, we sum over the full states of the Hilbert space going between any two operators. And the way we propagate these states is using their conformal dimension, which is the analog of the energies of the flux. And the transition from one to the other are computed by the structure constants, by the three-point functions, which is the analog of these pentagon transitions. Now, this is a lot of stories. It's nice to see how this works at leading order in perturbation theory. So I want to show how this works in the simplest example at leading order in perturbation theory. I'll do it in a second, but so far, what enters into the existence of this decomposition is only the symmetry of the problem, only the fact that we have a conformal theory. Integrability comes next. Integrability really allows us to solve for each term in this expansion. And the reason is that the flux tube states are dual to operators at very, very large spin. If we have a local operator and we apply to it many, many null derivatives in some direction, what this derivative eventually does is delocalize the operator along a null direction. And then you get a one-to-one map between the dimensions or the twists of local operators in this large spin limit and the states of the flux. And in that way, all the spectrum of the flux was solved at finite value of the coupling. Not only the spectrum, but also the scattering phases between excitations on top of this flux. All these excitations are gapped. And the flux is infinite, so we can really separate them and scatter them with each other and measure the scattering phases. So in this sum, we know a priori how to sum over states and how to propagate them on each flux by the geometry of the pentagon, by the distance from the collinear limit, using the dispersion relation from integrability. Now, the most non-trivial term and the interesting one are what are the analog of the three-point functions, which is what are these pentagon transitions that allow us to take the state of the flux in one the state of the flux in one square to the next. And these are these pentagon transitions. So now let's look on the, to understand what these objects are, let's look on the simplest one, which is the one between a single scalar excitation here on the bottom and a single scalar excitation here on the top. And the way I want to look on it is just at leading order in perturbation theory. Try to feel and see what it is. And this is really how this whole project started. We asked what are these pentagon transitions look like at leading order in perturbation theory. So this R3 here is some next to MHV 7-point ratio function, which at three level is just a three level next to MHV scattering amplitude. Mm-hmm. Now, using the map to Wilson loop that was extended beyond MHV in this paper, this specific component, this specific elicity choice for a next to MHV 7-point amplitude is trivially computed in the Wilson loop picture. In the Wilson loop picture, it's just a free propagator between a scalar insertion here at the bottom cusp and another scalar insertion here at the top cusp. So in other words, this three-level amplitude in the Wilson loop is just computed by 1 over x minus y squared, dressed by some spinor-elicity factors coming here between these two cusps. This is just a trivial free propagator. Now what happened to this trivial free propagator when we go and write it in terms of the OP variables, in terms of this tau, sigma, and phi, and take the collinear limit. And take the limit, where in that case, we have two middle squares, so we have two taus. Take the limit when we take edge 1 and 7 to be collinear, and 5 and 4 to be collinear. So this is what we do here. Tau 1 is the distance for the collinear limit here, tau 2 is the distance for the collinear limit here, and sigma 1 and sigma 2 parameterize the location of the scalar along the bottom and the top edge. And this is what this free propagator look like in these variables. Still, some rational function of the exponent of tau, sigma, and phi, which are the conformal cross ratios of this heptagon. Now, what happens when we take this result, this free propagator, and Fourier transform it to momentum space? The same free propagator can be written in momentum space just as a product of some gamma functions. Okay? When you pick the residues of this gamma function, you reproduce the power expansion of this rational function. Now, when we first saw this combination of gamma function, it looked familiar. It looked familiar from the following reason. When you take this flux and put only two scalar excitation and compute the scattering phases between them, the result is just a ratio of exactly two such sequence of gamma function when you exchange the two rapidities, the two momentum. This led us to conjecture that this relation really holds not only at leading order in perturbation theory, but also at finite coupling. And you went and checked it at one loop and a two loop, and it continued to hold very highly non-trivial. So the first conjecture is that if you take such a pentagon transition and exchange the two momentum, what you get is the flux tube S matrix. And you see this axiom already tell you that this transition, what they are roughly, is just a square root of the S matrix. Because if the S matrix, when you replace the two momentum, the S matrix from unitarity goes to 1 over itself. Now to completely solve for this pentagon transition, we need another axiom. We tell us how to move excitation from one edge to another. This is called a mirror transformation, which is something that is very well established in integrability. It's an analytic continuation of the momentum of the excitations that effectively take the excitation on one edge of the flux and move it to the next. And when you do that to a pentagon transition, you get the following relation. Now, given these two axioms, there is a very natural finite coupling solution, because we know both the S matrix and what this analytic continuation is. And this finite coupling solution takes the following form. We see that P is indeed roughly the square root of the S matrix, here divided by the S matrix between an excitation and an excitation that goes in the mirror channel. Now this was for, this is really a connection between a space-time quantity, which was control the collinear limit of a four-dimensional scattering amplitude, and the worksheet scattering phase between two excitations on the flux. This was the result for one excitation. But what about many excitations? For many excitations, we find that the transition just factorized into 2-to-2 transitions. We have transition between the old excitation on the bottom and only the excitation on the top, divided by transition between the top and themselves and the bottom and themselves. And this is up to some group theoretical and coupling independent matrix part. So really, you see the hallmark of integrability, where these pentagon transitions are factorized into the atoms, which are the transitions between single particle excitation. So now we go and check this integrability prediction against known weak coupling prediction. So before we saw this function F that appeared in the collinear limit of this heptagon next to MHV at 3 level, we now go and check it at 1 and 2 loops. So the same function was computed at 1 loop, and here it takes much more non-trivial form. It's computed by these gentlemen, and this is the integrability prediction in momentum space for the same quantity, where these H's are just combination of psi functions, which are log derivative of gamma functions. And when we go and put this on the tool on the computer and do the Fourier transform to compare them, we find precise match. Next, we go to two loops. And the two loops, this is the form the same function takes. It goes very fast. This was taken out from a paper of Karen Hott and he. And just look more closely, this is what this function looks like. It has function like Li 2 or Li 1,3. And this X and Y here are just exponent of minus 2 sigma 1 and minus 2 sigma 2. Now this is really a monster that you can get to work on the spot or not work at all. Something in between is almost impossible to fix. And we go and compare this to the integrability prediction, and it matches on the face. Not only did it match, the same code now automatically can give you any higher loop for this quantity F. Now, as you heard yesterday, not only that we can now match with perturbation theory, the most advanced computation in perturbation theory now rely on data from the OPE. And this was the talk of Matteo yesterday. What they do in the hexagon function program, they give an ansatz for what type of functions the answer should be in, and they have some finite number of coefficients, therefore, to fix. And it's enough to give some very minimal OP data to fix all the remaining coefficients that they have in the ansatz. And once all the ansatz is completely fixed, all the other term in the expansion are really consistent with checks of both the integrability prediction and the hexagon function program. And this turned out to be very fruitful for both directions. So this was at weak coupling. We can now go and check what happened at strong coupling. And at strong coupling, what we expect is that a minimal holographic string would emerge out of the OPE sum. So when we go and look on the OPE sum at leading order at strong coupling, we find the following answer. At leading order, there is just one, which is the trivial propagation of the vacuum. And after this one, we see three type of states. So here we have the strong coupling dispersion relation, which is always relativistic. We have here two excitation of angular momentum 1 and minus 1, and mass square root of 2, and one excitation which is neutral under the angular momentum and has mass 2. And this exactly matches the fluctuation of what is called the GKP string, the string that is dual to the flux, at leading order at strong coupling. It has two transfer excitation of mass 2 and one ADS radial excitation of mass 2. Now something very miraculous happened at strong coupling, that we don't just have to stop here at the leading term in the OP expansion, but we can really resum the full series. And when we do so, out of nowhere, what emerged is the minimal surface area that was computed before using completely geometrical technique and not using this OP. So we really see how a solution to a purely geometrical strong coupling result come out from some quantum gauss of particle that we resum once we tune the particle to be very, very large. What I want to describe next is a paper that is going to be out very soon, where we put the full 6-point amplitude at finite coupling. And what it means to put the full 6-point amplitude at finite coupling, 6-point amplitude is computed by the hexagon Wilson loop, which in our decomposition have 2 pentagons. So to give the full 6-point amplitude at finite coupling means amount to explain first how to sum over all the flux tube state. Each flux tube state comes with some measure of integration. The most non-trivial parts are these pentagon transitions, which are the amplitudes for to create the state on the bottom and annihilate it on the top. Now, if you go beyond MHV, the hexagon next to MHV, there is another factor here, which we call form factors, and this is what allows us to distinguish between the different ellipticity configuration of the 6-point amplitudes. These form factors are not really new quantities that one should bootstrap. They follow from the pentagon transition themselves. And the way they follow is that to change the ellipticity of external particle, you have to act with a supercharge. And on the flux tube, supercharge are realized by zero-momentum fermions. Now, adding a zero-momentum fermion is something very simple and natural to do in the OPE. This is what we always do. So in that way, we get for free, after solving for the MHV case, all other ellipticities. We just add one more fermion and send its momentum to zero, and we get the non-MHV diagram. And the last ingredient we want to have to give are what are the energies, what are the dispersion relation of these excitations. Once having all these building blocks, what we aim to do next is to go and plot the amplitude at some generic value of the conformal cross ratio, which is should be inside the radius of convergence of the OP, all the way from weak to strong coupling. This is the analog plot that was plot for the Konishi operator, and I think that is the hallmark of the fact that the spectrum problem was solved. Here we want to be able to compute the dimension of the Konishi operator at any value of the coupling to an arbitrary precision. What we aim to do now is the same for the problem of computing scattering amplitude. By truncating the sum, it's a sufficiently large energy, and interpolating between weak to strong coupling, we should be able to produce the analog plot for a scattering amplitude. And this is work in progress with the Matteo, who's here. Let me just flash into... These are complicated objects, and I would not present them here. Let me just flash one thing about the dispersion relation of these excitations. How this dispersion relation of this excitation are being computed? As I told you before, the way we extract them, the way they were extracted, are from the solution to the spectrum problem. And there one starts from a very different type of operator. These are operators with many, many scalars, called BMN operators. These are scalars are dictated by Z's here. And then we put some derivative inside them. And we take, eventually, the number of derivatives to be very, very large. That way, instead of thinking about these operators as a vacuum of Z's and some excitation, which are the derivatives, you have to go into a picture where the derivatives are the vacuum and the scalars and other excitations are the excitation on top of the vacuum. And there is a very Pascal way of doing it in integrable theories, which call operator excitation hole duality. And when you apply it to the flux, you find the following spectrum of excitations. There are 3 types of fundamental excitations: scalars, fermions, and gluons. All of them at weak coupling start with their free energy, which is 1. The gluons go to square root of 2 at strong coupling. This was one of the excitations we saw before. The scalar's mass goes to 0 at strong coupling. They become massless. Where the fermions stay at 1 at any coupling. And the reason for that is that, first you see that they have different energies, so supersymmetry here is completely broken. But these fermions are just the Goldstone bosons of broken symmetry, and therefore their masses is protected and they stay 1 at any value of the coupling. Now, Once we have such a finite coupling solution, we can go and start extract the juice off of it. We can start and use it to some other applications. So let me now describe a few of these applications. Each application can be a talk on its own, so I would not have time to go to any details, but I just want to give you the main idea of each application. Now, the first application I would like to talk about is the factorization limit. We know that if we take, for example, 6 gluon n to NMHV amplitude, this is the first amplitude in n equal to 4 that have a multiparticle factorization pole, upon which it factorized into 2 4-point MHV amplitudes times the pole. And when you go and study this factorization limit in perturbation theory, you find that indeed you get 2 4-point MHV amplitude times the pole times some function here, which is some function of the momentum invariance of the amplitude. So the same factorization pole look in the Wilson loop as the limit where two cusps of the Wilson loop become null separated. And if the Wilson loop would factorize, it would factorize here into two null square, which are the analog of these two four-point amplitude here. The same factorization limit is also related to another limit that was studied for a correlation function in which local operator become null separated in a pair. So the question now I want to ask, given a finite coupling result, is how this factorization look at finite coupling, and does the amplitude indeed factorize in that way at finite value of the coupling. So when we go and take this limit in the OP, let me give you a flavor of the answer, we get the following simple integral, and that this integral I compute is the relevant part of the amplitude in that limit. This is highly trivial integral, just integral du from 0 to infinity, e to the minus u times p squared, and here stand gamma cusp time log of u squared. And gamma cusp, you can think about it as this is the cusp anomalous dimensions, or the tension of the flux. And it starts at weak coupling with g squared, and then get higher loop corrections. So how this integral, this simple integral, look in perturbation theory? When we try to compute it in perturbation theory, we will bring down from the exponent powers of gamma cusp, or of the coupling, times log u squared. So if we now rescale u by p, we immediately get the pole, and then we get a polynom in log of p squared. So when we expand it in that way, we really get the same structure as we see at weak coupling. We get the pole times expansion in the coupling times the polynoms of the momentum square. And these polynoms, much precisely, which was what computed by Dixon and Van Happel, up to 3 loops in perturbation theory. So from this simple integral, one automatically reproduces all the known quantities for this factorization limit in perturbation theory. And it's trivial to give higher loop prediction, just expand it to higher loop in the coupling and get the higher polynoms. But note something very strange. What happens if we don't expand this integral in perturbation theory, but just set the momentum to zero? If we just set the momentum to zero, what remains is with the gamma cusp times log u squared. And this operation is enough to make this integral finite. So at finite coupling, if you really first go to the multiparticle pole factorization point, but keep the coupling finite, there is no pole. Seems like nothing special happens there. Still, when we go and look deeper, there is still something happening there, which is the following. The amplitude at finite coupling has a discontinuity around this multiparticle factorization point. And the discontinuity of this 6-point amplitude is go like e to the minus gamma cusp time log square of this momentum that goes to zero. In other words, there is a discontinuity, but this continuity is exponentially suppressed at the factorization point. Maybe a graph that describes what is going on is the following. Here we have this momentum that the factorization point is here when it goes to zero, and this direction is the amplitude or the discontinuity of the amplitude. And we see that there is a discontinuity that starts here, but here is exponentially suppressed, but it grows and then decays. A generic value of the coupling, it is not big. It is much smaller than some other background of the amplitude, which is of order 1. But as we take the coupling to be very, very small, it grows and becomes a very large contribution and eventually will dominate the amplitude near the factorization point. But at the factorization point, it's strictly zero. This is what one would also expect upon physical reasoning. If we demand that there is a discontinuity, we demand that there is some particle here that go on shell. However, its finite value of the coupling, it will dressed by many, many, many soft gluons. These are the Sodakov-Front factor that will suppress the amplitude and will give you this exponential suppression. Okay, so this was the first application that I described. I want to go now to the next. And the next one is how amplitude look at strong coupling. As we talked before, what we believe that they are computed at strong coupling by some minimal surface area. Here we see the surface area like of a soap bubble, of a string that ends on the corresponding pentagon on the boundary of ADS and is extended into the bulk. But as we described before, now having a finite coupling solution, we can go and test this. When you take the OP sum and expand it in the collinear limit and at strong coupling, we find the following result. It's indeed given by an exponent of square root of lambda times this minimal surface area, which is the most interesting and non-trivial part of the answer. And then you get here in red some quantum correction. This function F6 is function that starts itself in the collinear limit as 1 over tau square root plus sigma square to some power, and that then get exponentially small corrections. What you expect usually from quantum corrections is that it will not be in the exponent. It will be like one loop determinant, the rest in the exponent. But note that one piece of the quantum correction is really sitting here in the exponent. In other words, here the quantum corrections is of the same order as the classical minimal area piece. And this is something that very strange and a priori would not be able to predict it. That the quantum fluctuations are so strong in this case. And what is the reason for that? The reason for that is that, as we discussed before, one of the excitations of the flux, the scalars, their masses goes to zero at strong coupling. Their mass is exponentially small. It goes like exponent of minus square root of lambda over 4 at strong coupling. Now, we have an infinite flux and some excitation that become massless. So in this limit, it's not surprising that they give a large effect due to their fluctuation. Really, what we have to do is to resum all the scalar contribution, and they lead to this exponent quantum correction to the minimal area. Okay? So to summarize, we see that a strong coupling, the most interesting part of the answer is indeed computed by the minimal area, but the quantum correction are not small and are indeed of the same order as the minimal area solution. We go to the next application. And the next application is once we have the amplitude in what is called the collinear limit, we can go and try to analytically continue it to other kinematical regimes. And one such regime is called the BFKL regime or the multi-regi limit. And we can go and start to look how the amplitude look in that regime now at finite value of the coupling. Now, what is this limit? Here is for this limit for a 6-point amplitude where we divide it into a free and free particles, and we act with a big boost on free of the particle compared to the other. In other words, we put a big rapidity gap between these two. And what happened in perturbation theory in this limit is that the amplitude have an expansion which is very similar to the OP expansion. It has expansion that was obtained by summing leading logs and is indeed similar to the OP expansion. What we did in this paper is analytically continue the OP result to this kinematical regime. And what we find is that this expansion really makes sense at finite coupling. And it's valid way beyond summing leading logs. We are able to compute what is the analog of the energy for the OP expansion, which in the BFKL case called this omega. its finite value of the coupling, and this is the way it looks at leading order in the coupling to those of you who are familiar with the BFKL. So we see that the expansion is valid at finite value of the coupling. Not only that, we can even find a strong new strong coupling solution that describes the BFKL excitation. Note that this BFKL excitation is what is called the adjoint BFKL excitation, not to be confused with the more commonly discussed one, which is the singlet one, dual to closed string. This one is dual to open string. Let me now discuss few connections between the OP approach and the other integrability approaches for computing scattering amplitudes in n equal to 4. So we saw that in the operator Pollock expansion, what we do is really choose a channel. We decompose the amplitude into the sequence of fluxes. And therefore, by this choice, we like break all the global symmetries. Even the cyclicity of the amplitude is completely not manifest in this approach. Not to speak about the full Yangian that is not manifest. Therefore, understanding how these symmetries come about in the OP, I think, would be very fruitful for both approaches. For the OP, it will be maybe essential for understanding maybe how to resum it into some master function that upon expansion near the collinear limit give us the OP expansion. Now, I think we are now in position to start to understand cyclicity and the Cuber equation, which was the hallmark of the Yangian for amplitude. And the reason is the following. To understand cyclicity, what we should do is start with some configuration of the cross ratios that we can expand in the OP and try to go slowly analytically continue them to the next channel. And then when you do that, what we expect is that the excitation of the flux will be forced to go through this mirror transformation and jump from one edge to the next. We can now really go and study and see how this is happening from the flux to point of view. The way to understand the Cuber equation is the following. The Cuber equation is left and right hand side. The left hand side acts as some derivatives of the amplitude, which translate into derivative with respect to tau, sigma, and phi. Well, the right hand side, or the left hand side, which sometimes is called the holonomy, is realized by inserting some zero momentum, again, a zero momentum fermion on top of the edges of the Wilson loop. And again, inserting zero momentum fermion is very natural and simple thing to do from the OP. So we can really now realize both sides of the Cuber equation and understand why they give the same answer using the flux, the finite coupling point of view. I refer you to this paper for a recent perturbative check of this from the amplitude. Next, we can make a simple connection to deform on-shell diagram. And the first thing will be if people that deform the amplitude will give us some 6-point deform next to MHB amplitude, what one can do then is go and expand it in the OP variables. And upon doing so, what I would expect to get is some deformed OPE building blocks, some deformed pentagon transitions, and so on. In that way, really make the connection between the two. Now, to make a connection with on-shell diagrams, this is a work in progress by Gaiotto and Dalimer. What they are doing is computing the correlation function between a polygon Wilson loop, dual to scattering amplitude, and a local operator, which is the Lagrangian insertion. Once you do that in the OPE, here, for example, we have the hexagon Wilson loop, and here the local operator insertion, we divide it as we do in the OPE, some amplitude to create excitation from the bottom hexagon, amplitude to annihilate this excitation on the top, from the top pentagon, and in the middle, we have here the propagation on the middle square that has now the local operator insertion into it. And therefore, now the state here on the bottom of the square does not have to be the same as the state on the top, and we have a new building block to bootstrap. And once you bootstrap it, you can compute this correlation function. This is the case for when you have one such local operator insertions, but you can then continue and have any number of local Lagrangian insertions. And at the point where the number of Lagrangian insertions is equal to the loop order that we are working in, this gives you a direct connection between the OP and on-chill diagrams. Because what you put inside is just the on-chill diagram, and OP decompose it. Let me summarize with a bit of an outlook question for the future. What we hope to do in the future is to plot an amplitude, for example, the 6-point amplitude, for some generic value of the kinematics all the way from weak to strong coupling. What I very much hope so exists, but is not guaranteed, is if this OP expansion can be resummed into some master object at finite coupling in the same way it has been resummed at strong coupling. We can now go and start to extend this expansion to other kinematical regime. And today I discussed one such regime, which was the BFKA limit, but the amplitude also have many other interesting kinematical regime. For example, also the multi-particle pole is one of these regimes that I discussed today as well. We can go and study more the connection with the other approach, what I just discussed. Hopefully at some point still use integrability techniques to go beyond the planar limit. And what's having such a finite coupling solution can have, hope it can have some application to other theories. You can understand general structures of amplitudes, for example, this multi-particle factorization pole that I discussed, that I expect to be generic for any theory. We want to study some lessons to non-perturbative quantum field theories, lesson to large N QCD and effective QCD description. They have also there an excitations that very much resemble what we find here for n equal to 4. It can be a test ground for numerical QCD. If you have some code that's supposed to compute part of QCD, you can first apply it to a case where we know what the answer should be and test if the code gives you the right answer, and only then apply it to QCD. And maybe sometime in the very far future to develop some perturbative expansion around this theory, around n equal to 4 super Young Hills. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to Amit for that very nice talk. Are there any questions?
So when you look at the factorization of the amplitude and then the pole disappear because of something which you related to Sudakov suppression, is there any role for what is called the collinear anomalous dimension? I was a bit surprised by the fact that you got just, you know, gamma cast log squared. Whereas if I think of Sudakov, there is another piece, which is this, you know, some people call it G single log.
Oh,
you don't have that.
Yeah, I think there is also a single log. I was just describing the leading suppression factor.
Oh, so you would have...
This is still work in progress, but I think there is also a single log, yes.
When you discussed the strong coupling result and you showed us that there is an additional constant square root of lambda over 12 squared factor, is that factor universal? I mean, does it depend on the number of particles?
It depends only on the number of particles. And it's proportional to n minus 4 times n minus 5 times some factor.
Okay. Would you have a guess what it would be for a smooth loop?
Again?
For a smooth loop, would you also accept something
like that? No, this factor is really related to the fact that the flux is infinite and there is a massless excitation. So only when you have the cast, you have some infinite regime of the flux, and therefore you have a large quantum effects. But for a smooth Wilson loop, I don't expect the worksheet to be effectively infinite, and therefore I don't expect strong IR effects.
Central ingredient was an axiom that you presented, or really a working assumption that allowed you to get some knowledge about finite coupling and achieve all these spectacular results. Can you comment why is it about the prospects for proving it or understanding, and in particular, could the formulation of it, is there any freedom to change the formulation with time?
Yes, so the way really to think about this pentagon transition from the worksheet point of view is as a form factor. This is a form factor for a worksheet operator that creates for you a new asymptotic region, a new edge, starting from the four points to the five, starting from the square to the pentagon, creates for you another wedge. Now, the study of form factor in integrable theories is something that is very much developed. And one of the basic axioms that is kind of built in there is that when you take two excitations on the same edge and exchange them, you pay the S matrix. Now, there is also what is called a minimal solution to also for form factors, there are natural bootstrap axiom, which are not exactly the one I presented. And this solution in general is much more complicated than what we have. But what we find for some toy models is that something very specific happened when you consider pentagons or when you consider the matter content of n equal to 4, is that this minimal solution really telescope down to the simple solution we have. In other words, this axiom that when you take two excitations of the same edge and exchange them, the one that I presented do not follow it from it, but only the other way around. You have to use some five-point relation to derive the standard one from form factor from the one I presented. It's consistent, but I'm saying here there is an additional miracle that is happening, that when you exchange two excitations that are not on the same edge, you also pay the S matrix. And we can really see how this happening when you change the matter of the theory, our much more complicated solution is collapsing to a simple solution that do satisfy this, but a priori I wouldn't know to derive it or to say when it should be valid or when not.
Thanks for the very nice talk. So my question is, so the final result you present is still an infinite sum.
Yes.
So, and I think when you, if you mentioned that you do some finite coupling plotting of this curve, so you need to make some truncations.
Yes.
So I just wondering, how good is the convergence behavior when you do these truncations? And
so the convergence of this sum is really controlled by the gap of the flux tube. Okay, how massive are the lowest excitation? Now, as we saw before, maybe if I order fast, I got pass too fast. Anyhow, here. You see, generic value of the coupling, all the excitations are gapped, and the convergence is really controlled by the least massive excitation, e to the minus tau times the mass of the lowest excitation. And only at strong coupling is really you have to first resum all the scalars, which is what we already achieved, and then on top of it have the other excitation. Okay. And of course, as in any OPE, this sum is some finite radius of convergence. Okay. This tau has to be bigger than zero, at least.
Okay, so are there any final questions? Okay, so if not, let's thank Amit again.